Welcome back to War, Economy, and State, the foreign policy podcast of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. This week, we're going to talk a little bit about the fact that the Republican Party and the Democratic Party joined forces to approve even more money for the Ukraine regime and, of course, for the ongoing war between the State of Israel and Hamas. And we're going to look a little bit at how there was a lot of public opposition to this and neither party cared at all. So as much as I may be contacted by people telling me that America is far too democratic, well, I can assure you that the people in charge don't care that much about what the voters are actually saying when it comes to many different issues. And so here joining me, of course, today is Zachary Yost. And we're going to talk about this a little in quite a bit more detail here for this episode. But first, I just wanted to note that if you are interested in the Mises Institute and the topics we cover, you might consider coming to our next event, which is coming up in May. And that is the Human Action Conference. And this conference is going to cover the 75th anniversary of Ludwig von Mises' amazing economics book, Human Action. If you're not familiar with it, you can check it out for free online at Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org. But if you're interested in economics, in business cycles, in what's going on in our economy right now, you can learn a lot just from this conference. So that's coming up May 16th to May 18th at the Mises Institute campus in Auburn, Alabama. So go to Mises, M-I-S-E-S.org, and click on events, and you can sign up there. So looking at the foreign policy situation in the United States right now, clearly this is not being driven by any mass movement on the ground in favor of more intervention in the Ukraine and in the Middle East. And we could see that in what happened recently when the GOP's leader in the House, the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, he just comes out and says, hey, we're going to approve all of this money. Yes, I know that 60% of Republicans are opposed to this. Yes, I know that people are saying that their overwhelming concern is for the economy. But you know what? I'm not going to give for the economy and for the border, by the way, border security. But you know what? I don't care about that. I'm going to give $0 to border security. I'm going to give $0 to rebuilding bridges that are falling down. You know what I'm going to give tons of money to? The most corrupt regime in Eurasia, Ukraine. And that'll be great. That's a good idea. Let's do that, even though most voters hate the idea. And that's apparently how Washington runs. Now, predictably, in response to that, Johnson was hailed as a hero by the mainstream media. Oh, yeah, he bucked his own party. He went against it. And this is, of course, how it works in the Beltway in Washington, is when you go against what your own voters want, as long as it's in favor of what the regime wants, well, then you're a hero. And that was why John McCain always got praised, because John McCain could never have cared less about freedom. This was a guy who always wanted to protect and expand the regime, always wanted more war, always wanted more spying, always wanted more federal power. And of course, for that, he was called a maverick and a great hero who went against the rest of his party, which I don't even think is true. And that apparently is what's going on right now with the Speaker of the House. And an example of of this and how the Republicans are so horrible when they don't support more war is a April 24 column by George Will. Now, if you're under the age of 50 and you don't follow foreign policy closely, you may not know who George Will is. George Will, he's now about 80-something. But he was a fairly important columnist back in the 80s and to some extent in the 90s. But he's a cold warrior. His persona was always as this very even-handed, staid guy who just wanted what was best for America. The reality is that he was just always a neocon. I mean, always supported every war the United States could get into, but he had this very measured, calm tone about him. So a lot of people thought, oh, he was the reasonable guy in the room. But that was never true. He always just supported whatever it was that Dick Cheney wanted. And so now we've got George Will at it again. And he still hasn't gone away. I mean, he's definitely part of that Boomer Con movement, which is Ronald Reagan. They're still thinking it's the 1980s. Ronald Reagan is super important still, and we plaster pictures of him everywhere. And that was when the Republican Party was great. And so that's what they want, is a return to Reagan style. But actually, even worse than Reagan style, Reagan didn't get the U.S. into any wars. Probably more like a George H.W. Bush style Republican politics. Go abroad looking for new wars to start and, hey, invade Panama, invade Iraq, do all sorts of stuff and call it defending the free world. That's George Will's jam. That's what he likes. So here he is saying, here's the title of his piece. So 112 ignoble, infantile Republicans voted to endanger civilization, because not giving billions of dollars to Ukraine is apparently endangering civilization itself. You know, before I go into it myself, I'm just going to throw it over to you, Zach, and because you pointed out this article to me. So I'm going to let you just kind of kick it off and point out what you think of this article. Tell me, Zach, what is your opinion of this article?
Yeah, when I read it, I was just a bit taken aback slightly, not exactly surprised, because it's hard to be surprised these days. But as you said, he's sort of, you know, boomer con, neocon, cold warrior type person. And these type of people are generally out of touch, especially with the youth. And I'm no longer exactly a spring chicken now. Gen Z's replaced us. But it did just scream how out of touch so many people are. Given the economic troubles we're having here in America, the obsession with giving our money away, you know, and this all happened right around tax day too, which was, you know, a reason we shouldn't have withholding. So everyone had to write a check just as they're writing a check to give, you know, corrupt oligarchs. But yeah, it was just sort of a bit breathtaking in its ridiculousness, comparing Mike Johnson to Churchill, which is so absurd. It's just, you know, and George Will was not the first person to do this. A whole bunch of people have done this, and it's Mike Johnson is not Churchill. And it's just the whole piece seemed historically ridiculous. Just take a lot of issues with this sort of internationalist approach he identifies. It was just, I think it speaks ultimately to why a lot of people like Trump, you know, speak coming up in November, because he sort of upended the elites in both parties, but then he also pointed them to his administration. So who knows what will happen? There's been some talk that Trump gave the okay for this bill to be passed, you know, to Johnson. So I'm not exactly thinking, oh, Trump will fix everything. That's certainly not the case. But he is different than the old brand elites who have been, you know, just collecting a nice paycheck, urging the government to give our money to other people or to go to war and kill other people with people who aren't their children. So, yeah.
Well, and in case I didn't mention this before, this was in the Washington Post, right? This wasn't like George Will in some conservative small-time site, right? This is, of course, the Washington Post reprinted this, or actually, I guess, were the original publishers. Because, of course, all it is a bunch of bromides, pro-regime bromides, the usual stuff. You brought up Churchill, right? So let's look at that a little bit, that issue of, oh, yeah, it's World War II all over again. First of all, if you think that the situation between the United States and Russia is more or less similar to the situation between the United Kingdom and the Third Reich in 1939, you are not a serious person. Like, this is, it's absurd to compare. these things. And so let's just get that right out of the way. But you can see Will does the usual. It's like we should have had a pool going, Zach, where, okay,
what, bingo.
Right? Yeah, you're right. Bingo. Okay, where does he mention Munich and, right, Neville Chamberlain? Let's see. Oh, is that on our bingo card? Yep, here it is. Oh, okay, yep. George Will refers to Senator J.D. Vance as, quote, an itinerant Neville Chamberlain, unquote. I'm not sure what itinerant is supposed to mean in this context, but okay. And so, okay, we got the Neville Chamberlain out of the way. So you know that J.D. Vance or anyone who's not in favor of World War III is pandering to Hitler, basically. Let's see. We got that. What else do we have? Oh, we have domino theory. We got talking about how, oh, if you don't, quote unquote, defend Ukraine, well, then China will invade Taiwan. So that's a given. That's another slogan that the left likes to throw around. I'm not sure if you noticed anything else along those lines, but it was all, I mean, you can go through it. It's practically a checklist of the usual neoconish establishment left, center left stuff that you will hear over and over again every time there's some sort of foreign policy.
And anyone who disagrees with him is a traitor.
That's right. That's important too. And I mean, that's basically you endanger civilization. It's right there in the title. Which civilization? I'm not sure, or what kind of civilization, or I'm not sure why civilization is going to fall if Russia annexes Eastern Ukraine, but apparently that is the position. So, all right. So he gets the usual foreign policy stuff. It's the lesson of 1938. And I'll go back to a column I wrote. The lesson to learn in this war is not the lesson of 1938, it's the lesson of 1914. It's the lesson of you get involved in a bunch of pointless wars you don't need to be involved in. You end up with big problems and escalation that leads to a pointless world war. This is a World War I situation, not a World War II situation. And in case you weren't up on that, World War I was a complete wasted war. I know that some people still are reading old history books that make World War I look like there was some purpose to it. Nobody thinks that anymore. It was a completely pointless war, and everyone had died, and it died in vain because it didn't produce peace or any really good outcomes. It just paved the way for World War II. So that's really the situation we're looking at here, is something that would touch off 30 years of war like 1914 did. Will just gets everything wrong here. He talks about the 1854 Kansas-Nebraska Act, and he says that this is one of the worst things that's ever done since the 1854 Kansas-Nebraska Act, because it authorized territories to vote slavery up or down. This was a thing called popular sovereignty back then. I'm actually in the middle of writing a book review on two different books on this topic, just by coincidence. And what Will doesn't seem to understand is that actually popular sovereignty is the constitutional position backed up by the 10th Amendment. Also, you know, it was clearly the constitutional thing to do in 1854. And all Will is doing here is showing that he's completely against the rule of law and just thinks that the central government should just tell everybody what to do. And you could just see that throughout. Of course, Will has always supported spy, the garrison state, all of that. And he just wants endless spending. So I don't even know what point he's making here other than to trot out a bunch of the usual slogans. I mean, if you had to say what the thesis is of this article, is it anything other than anyone who voted against more funding for Ukraine is bad? I mean, he doesn't even really communicate anything new about Ukraine, except that Russians are bad and they're doing bad things in Ukraine and you should give Ukraine more money. He at no point says how this benefits the average American in any way, except to vaguely say it defends, civilization, whatever he means by that. I mean, did you pick up on any actual substantive theme here?
No. I was especially confused when he complained about Josh Hawley and said about how Josh Hawley's like, we can't, you know, we've been supposedly pivoting to Asia to balance against China. We're supposedly going to defend Taiwan. And there's people saying we can't be doing both, you know, already just aiding Israel. You know, we're rerouting supplies because we literally don't have them. I mean, the military industrial base, as we've discussed about before, is just, you know, as one might expect from an old, you know, government run sort of production plan, we're way behind, you know, Russia, even in terms of producing artillery shells, things like that. And he doesn't address, you would think he could say, like, we need a new buildup of, you know, weapons and, you know, we need to strengthen the military and bring back the draft because, you know, we'd would run out of troops in a Ukraine-like war within, like, a month. He doesn't say any of that. It's just sort of like emoting, really, like self-righteous emoting, no addressing the actual problems with the world as it is. And I just also want to go back to the Churchill point and all of his allusions to World War II as though such a great war. I am, you know, such a crazy radical person. I don't really see how World War II was a great good war from the American perspective. You know, it has been argued, even from people who are in favor of a more restrained foreign policy, that we can't let a Eurasian hegemon arise. So that's why we needed to go and fight Nazi Germany. Well, what was the result of our involvement in World War II? It was a very powerful Eurasian empire in the form of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact that was vastly larger and vastly more powerful than Nazi Germany ever was. So I think, you know, all these crowing about World War II from the American perspective, if you're British, of course you should be trying to get the United States into the war. Just like if you're, you know, a Ukrainian nationalist, you want NATO to join the war or whatever. But from an American perspective, it's unclear what World War II actually accomplished. So that is just a pet peeve of mine I have when everyone's like, oh, Churchill, you know, you're the new Churchill and all that. And the World War III talk is worrisome, just in terms of, like, it seems people don't take it seriously. Back in the actual Cold War, people were quite worried about, you know, rival states with thousands of nuclear warheads. Now, I see people just dismiss it as, we can't let Putin blackmail us with his nuclear weapons. I'm like, okay, this is worrisome, like, to talk like this. It's concerning. And I mean, George Will, you know, is rather old. So I guess that to some degree he might, you know, get a bit of a pass there. But when younger people are talking about that, who are going to be, you know, making policy in the decades to come, that's quite worrisome. That they just think nuclear weapons don't matter. another issue that Will doesn't exactly address, but he sort of hints at, touches on, and is constantly brought up by people who are like, we need to support. It's really just a new version of, we have to fight them over there so we don't have to fight them over here, which is so absurd. But everyone's like, if NATO sends troops to Ukraine, you know, in a rear, you know, sort of rear logistical support thing, this will send such a message to Putin. He'll know he can't succeed, which Will sort of touches on when he's talking about the Japanese invasion of Manchuria and the Italian invasion of Abyssinia and all this. But what it makes no sense, it's like, because in the same essay, oftentimes, these same people will say, if he succeeds in Ukraine, he will attack NATO. So it's like, what? How then would NATO involvement in Ukraine deter him? It's really, it's either they are so ideologically blinded that they don't see this contradiction, or they're just engaging in pure propaganda. They don't themselves don't believe, and they don't, you know, they obviously know this is hogwash, but it's quite...
Yeah, you can't win because, oh, if Ukraine had been part of NATO, he never would have invaded Ukraine. And then in the next breath, oh, after he finishes with Ukraine, he's then going to invade Poland, a NATO member. So wait, I thought NATO prevented any Russian invasion. And yeah, that's a good question. It has to be either or there. Throughout the article, it's just always, it's 1930s this, 1930s that. And it's not just, of course, the Germans, it's the Japanese. And he, of course, refers to the Moscow-Beijing-Tehran axis.
Oh, goodness, yes. That would have been on the bingo card. it's the new axis of evil.
That is just, I think, a demonstration of how Will wants war with everybody. He wants a war with Moscow, he wants a war with China, he wants a war with Iran. I'm surprised you didn't include the maybe the Damascus axis as part of this. So why not include all of that? And yeah, he basically compares all of them to the Italians, Hitler, and the Japanese. He's got no analogy other than World War II. And this is real typical for the neoconservative types, is they've got nothing. There was no war in history except World War II. For them, except maybe the Peloponnesian War. They like to bring that up because that enforces their whole that conundrum of, oh, war is inevitable. The Thucydides trap, they like to bring that up in that, oh, you can't let any country get powerful because then that'll just inevitably lead to a world war anyway. So we need all of these preemptive wars to prevent any other rising power sort of thing. So I guess they allow two different wars.
Yeah,
they'll talk about. They never mention World War I, of course. They never mention the Mexican War and all of these pointless American wars that took place. It's always World War II. But just I before we move on to kind of this gap between the elites and the regular people, I wanted to mention just so you know what's in this article. He does mention that he refers to how Eisenhower, Reagan, and Mitch McConnell are the three most important Republicans of the past 100 years. This is an actual sentence. And he praises, of course, the Senate voting for the Ukrainian aid. And this passes Dwight Eisenhower's baton of Republican internationalism via Ronald Reagan to Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell is the inheritor of the legacy of Dwight Eisenhower and Ronald Reagan. Now, I'm not the world's biggest fan of Dwight Eisenhower or Ronald Reagan, but where in what universe is Mitch McConnell like Reagan-esque or Eisenhower-esque? it's kind of funny. It's really just quite comical to include this in there. But that's kind of the tone of this article. It sounds like he's writing a memo for his other elderly friends who are reminiscing about the good old days of conservatism. And I think a great antidote of a lot of this maybe is to watch, and I watched this just the other day, is a recent, it's from the last couple of months. It's an interview with Mearsheimer and Piers Morgan. I don't know if you watched that.
I haven't watched that one, no.
It's about an hour. And Piers Morgan, of course, not exactly one of the world's great critical thinkers, basically, he just repeats all the usual bingo card slogans to Mearsheimer and says, well, what about this? Well, what about that? And it's all the usual stuff like, well, since America defends democracy, this is what America exists for, is to defend democracy. How can you justify not fighting this war? And of course, Mearsheimer comes back with, well, I question your knowledge of American history, peers, because if you think America's in the business of only defending democracies, you don't seem to know what's going on. And so that's an important point to be made. Where did they get this myth, just this idea? Well, I guess they get it from the propaganda. It's certainly not based on historical events, this idea that America's in the business of defending democracies. And in it's this arsenal of democracy is the other slogan, the phrase that people may have heard, that the United States is the arsenal of democracy. And that's why the United States has to be involved in Ukraine, is because this is why the U.S. exists. Please point out for me the part of the U.S. Constitution that says something along those lines. I think you will look in vain. And let's just point to historical facts. The Vietnam War had nothing to do with the arsenal of democracy. The Mexican War had certainly nothing to do with that. I can't think of a single war, really. Oh, wait, defending Kuwait was about being an arsenal of democracy? a dictatorial regime in the Middle East? And of course, U.S. policy has always been to defend Saudi Arabia, certainly one of the most brutal, blood-soaked regimes in the world. And that's supposed to be, I guess, part of the arsenal of democracy. But I guess if you just don't know anything about U.S. foreign policy history, that might seem plausible to you. And since I'm sure Piers Morgan doesn't know anything about it, it seems plausible to him. But I would recommend that Mearsheimer interview, and we'll link that in the description if you just kind of want some of the comebacks on this. Now, Mearsheimer gets China wrong. Mearsheimer's in favor of U.S. intervention in Asia. But he does correctly point out that, let's face it, Ukraine has absolutely nothing to do with the defense of the United States and with U.S. national interests. It just doesn't. And you can see, though, that I guess the support comes for it out in terms of, hey, it funnels lots of money to the war party. And that seems to be really the only, the cynical view is really the only one I find convincing or realistic. But you've got these guys like George Will to push kind of the idealistic view, which it rings so hollow now.
Yeah. For some good history on the United States, and that has, you know, influenced my interpretation of these George Will types, I would recommend The War for Righteousness by Richard Gamble and Promised Land Crusader State by Walter McDougall. Because ultimately, Piers Morgan is like, America exists to defend democracy. Really, that is a religious, like, it is this idea that America exists as this, like, armed camp to spread the religion of democratism, which is another great book, The Ideology of Democratism. I highly recommend that. It is a political religion, as Eric Voglin would call it. And it calls to mind, there's this hilarious scene in the in this 80s British comedy show called Yes, Prime Minister, where the prime minister, I can't recall exactly what the situation is, but he wanted to become military involved in some situation because it was the right thing to do. And that's what Britain stands for, is doing the right thing and defending the weak against the strong. And then Sir Humphrey Appleby, who is like this career bureaucrat, is like, well, why don't we dispatch troops to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan? And then Prime Minister Hacker says, Soviets are too strong. You know, so at least in the 80s, they had some sense of limits. And going back to your point about the Thucydides and all that, this recalls an essay I wrote in response to Victor Davis Hanson, where his theory of why wars happen is because some people are just naturally aggressive and warmongering. And he argues that the Japanese are like this. And Will sort of seems to be implicitly saying the same thing about the Russians. There's no discussion of the Russian motives for anything from their point of view. And it's just, I recently reviewed Mearsheimer's most recent book on state rationality. And I have a bunch of criticisms of it, but the historical case studies are very interesting, one of them being Japan in World War II. And the Victor Davis Hansons of the world just think, oh, the Japanese are just, genetically bloodthirsty. And, Mearsheimer points out, the Japanese thought a great deal about launching this war. They did not even think it was likely they would win, but they launched it anyway because of U.S. actions basically squeezing them economically. They're going to run out of oil and metal and various things. So when he talks, when George Will talks about, this evil new axis of evil, it's like, why, how did that axis arise? Because if you would look at IR literature from, a few decades ago, this would not have been on, the most likely things to happen. The Soviet Union and China were literally engaged in like a very long, very low-grade border war, constantly shelling each other over these little islands in the Amur River. And until really, until quite recently, the majority of Russia had an enormous military presence in the Russian Far East because of China. And they withdrew lots of those forces because they came to an agreement with China to some degree. Iran, it's in these three states' interests to act together, but it's not a sort of a particularly natural partnership. They have many of their own disagreements and problems and historical gripes with each other. And it's like, why are they working together? George Will doesn't ponder that question at all, which I would encourage people to ponder. Because then you might be able to avoid war if you understand why people care about certain things.
Well, as you know, in international relations scholarship, that's considered to say that, to skip the explanation and say these people do that because they're these people, is considered a no-no. It's considered a cop-out. It's considered a cheat. It's considered skipping to the end. So in the sense of, right, why are the Russians doing XYZ? Well, that's what Russians do. That's not considered serious scholarship. That's considered, I don't have an answer here for this, or I'm too lazy to provide an answer, or I don't like the answer. So I'm just going to say there's something about the Russian soul, or right, Russian DNA. This is, a lot of racists are like this, right? Is that like, why does this group do XYZ? Well, it's because of who their great grandmother was, and they share this particular gene and all of this stuff.
Yes. Well, Foreign Affairs, I believe, was originally called the Journal of Race Science, I believe.
So the origins are there. So they're still trying to overcome that by, hey, you have to provide an actual reason why the Russians do this and not just, well, because they're Russian. And we all know Russians are barbarians. In fact, that's what Will does in the column. He refers to them as barbarians. That's very 15th century sort of stuff.
The war is messy and all that. And so atrocities are happening, no doubt. But it's a little bit on the nose about how he's complaining that the Russians are digging people's eyes out with spoons and everything and indiscriminately, carpet bombing Ukrainian cities, which is not true, by the way. And this same aid package he praises as so heroic sent funding to both Palestine and Israel. And Israel is, turning Gaza into a parking lot, basically. So,
yeah, if you want to see indiscriminate bombing, go to the State of Israel. That's where you'll see it.
It's a horrible, complicated situation, as we've talked about, but it's not like Israel is not, flattening Gaza. So it's just, I don't know if he would even think of that, or if he is just like, if he's so, you know, caught up in his sort of self-righteous pseudo-religion that he would even catch this contradiction, or so cynical that he didn't care. I don't know, but.
Well, let's go to the final topic for today, which is this gap between people like Will, who I think reflects a substantial portion of foreign policy thinking in Washington, and then just regular people who can see that obviously if Ukraine ceased to exist, that would have virtually zero impact on the average American who's paying all the bills, by the way. Remember, everything these people do is with your money. It's not with any money they earned. They're not sacrificing their own children in this war. They're not doing any, they've got no skin in this game. And they love it. It's the same chicken hawk phenomenon, of course, that we had in the Iraq War, right? You got guys like Dick Cheney and his friends, all of whom just managed to avoid service in Vietnam, in many cases avoided any sort of military service whatsoever, but love starting new wars. And I see Congress here lecturing the country about not being supportive enough of whatever the latest war is, a war that could lead to a nuclear exchange in World War III, and talking down to Americans who are paying all the bills, that they just don't get it, that they need to get behind the effort. So why does Washington just not even care? Because when we look at the polling, we see that at best, the war party in this case, it's about 50-50. In many cases, certainly within the Republican Party, you're seeing on many of these polls 60% opposition to ongoing war in Ukraine and ongoing funding. Only about, if you look at the polls, and at least two different polls say, you've got about 15 to 20% of those polled say that support for Ukraine is not enough. And it's a heavy majority says either it's too much or it's sufficient. As is. So this idea that we need to really step up the situation, we need to do more funding, this seems to be a Washington hobby only. And why is that? What causes this big gap? And there's been scholarship on this for years. So why is this? Why does Washington not care? Why are they so much more interventionist than the regular taxpayers? What's going on there?
I wish I had the definitive answer. There's a bunch of things that go into it. Of course, the intelligence community is, you know, all of the public choice stuff about bureaucracies constantly wanting to expand. And in bureaucracies that are concerned with war and all that, well, war is good for business. So they get, you know, Mike Johnson in the room and say, you know, if you don't do this, disaster. We're the experts. Listen to us. Also, I mean, there is just a flat out corruption of like, oh, I'm retiring from my seat. Oh, look, now I can get this gig at Boeing or Lockheed Martin or whoever else. So that's there. There is the ideological component of democratism, in contrast to democracy, being a pseudo religion, a political religion in the Voglinian sense of that being a universal religion requires crusades to spread this good news, the good news of democratism. And ultimately, it's very much in the vein of Rousseau's general will, because for Rousseau, the people must be made to be free, which by definition means being in alignment with the general will, which is not the majority will. The general will is not, you know, like everyone votes, okay, that's the general will. The general will is sort of this, you know, manifestation of, it's really a Gnostic manifestation, to use another Voglinian term. So they are the enlightened people who have converted to this universalist ideology, and all of us regular plebs are just too dumb and unenlightened and need to be dragged into the present the present day, where history has ended. History ended, people, if you didn't get the memo. So get on board. And it, as part of this universalist aspect of this religion, there is the symbolism when the House passed this bill was a punch in the nose. It wasn't just on the nose. It was a punch in the nose. It was, I was actually quite upset when the clip came out of tons of people, of congressmen, sitting members of Congress, and waving Ukrainian flags because they gave all this money to Ukraine. It's like they're, it's in the same line as people will say, this really gets into the whole nature of what the United States is. There are people who will say, I believe Ann Applebaum might have said this once, or someone, it was at a party she hosted, that, you know, people have recounted in print about how they've, you know, been at a party where there are foreigners, and they will say, you know, they'll be discussing some policy issue about foreign policy, and the person will say, I'm more American than you because I believe XYZ. This is where it leads, is the actual people in Americans are just like tax cattle, you know, to extract resources from and to employ in wars to, you know, spread the universalist religion. And to be an American, you don't even have to have ever lived in America. If you believe that, you know, if you accept the good news of democratism, you too, you can be an American, and you're more American than all those dumb hicks who go and join the Marine Corps and die for this religion in these crusades. So it's a sort of a blackpilling answer, I suppose. That's why I've been not following the news as closely as I usually do, because I've just been like, ugh, can't take this anymore.
Well, it is interesting to note that somebody had the good sense to not hand out Israeli flags and have everybody in Congress wave those. You can imagine how that would have got over.
Yes, yes.
but yeah, that, well, and you know, there was extra drama with that whole video.
Because, oh, yeah, Thomas Massie, yes, getting in trouble, yeah.
Yeah, Tom, so in case you don't follow Twitter, people, people with lives, Thomas Massie posts that, so he was the original source of that video, this video from the floor, and all these people waving Ukrainian flags, congressmen, and then he reports later on his Twitter account that he's going to be fined by the Speaker of the House if he doesn't take the video down. So the Republican leadership came to Massie and threatened him and said, we don't like that you shared this video, i.e. accurate information about what happened on the House floor. Take it down or we'll fine you $500. I don't know what happened to that. At that point, of course, multiple people, I'm sure, had downloaded it, reposted it. So it didn't even matter. And of course, Massie can also afford $500. So I don't know if he was just going to leave that up indefinitely, or if they were going to keep imposing new fines on him. Were they going to be like the IRS and start charging him interest on the unpaid $500, or do it how federal regulators do it? It'll be $500 for every day that this is up. I have no idea. But you can see how the establishment is so proud of its foreign policy that it has to keep it secret. And it doesn't want you to see what they're actually doing on the House floor. That is, they know that the people aren't with them. They know that what they're doing is a slap in the face to the taxpayers and the people who actually die in these wars, and the people whose economic fortunes are deeply impacted by ongoing international conflict. And they may not all see it, but it's there. And that's the reality. They don't want you to know the reality. They just want you to know the slogans. They just want you to know the propaganda. And that's where we are, I suppose, in America right now. And it's difficult to see how that's going to change, because, as you know, Trump is by no means a reliable opponent of this sort of thing, and certainly not on the Middle East. But I think it would just be slightly less bad, I guess, with Trump in the White House, but I don't know.
And there is the effort by Heritage and some other places. You know, a major problem of the first Trump administration was staffing, especially when it came to foreign policy. So all these places that are sort of the, they're called the New Right, but there was a New Right like 50 years ago. So it's just, that's just the shorthand we'll use as the New Right. Basically, people who are generally pro-Trumpist to some degree, anti-old Republican elite. And they're very sound, for the most part, generally on foreign policy. And they're basically putting together just a list of, apparently, like it's going to be tens of thousands of people to staff the next Republican administration, whether that's now or in who knows how long. So there is, you know, some hope that, you know, people have woken up to the bureaucratic institutional realities of getting things done. You know, you can't just become president and order something because people just not listen to you. As crazy as that sounds, it's happened many times in Trump's administration, specifically in regard to foreign policy. So there is some hope there. At the same time, it's, as I think I said in our last episode, it's just with Trump, you never know. He could double down and be like, America's prestige is at stake. It depends who's whispering in his ear. As you know, we're going to win this war. So, yeah, I am hopeful, but am not, you know, it's more of just an aspirational hope that I'm not, you know, I don't have any money down on it.
Well, and you haven't enlisted either, it seems.
Right, so. Yes. Oh, goodness, no. Yeah. Don't do that, people. Bad idea.
Yeah, there's more news on that topic. We should cover that in a future episode on just enlistment issues, too, and just funding. Yeah, the bottom is really falling out in terms of the public support as well. I think you would see, regardless of polls, if there was public support for these sorts of conflicts, I don't think you would be seeing the major staffing problems that the military right. has in terms of getting people to enlist. No, nobody has an interest in actually being involved in the military firsthand because they see what's going on. So that's another indicator as well. So with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up this episode of War, Economy, and State. Thank you for tuning in. If you have any questions or interest on topics related to these, be sure and visit our website, mises.org. We'll be back next month with another episode, so we'll see you next time.